WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Ready, Steady, Go is a new book about the time and place Austin Powers would be most at home in, swinging London in the 60s. Author Sean Levy says that in the 60s, London rose from a prim and fusty capital to the fashionable center of the modern world. His book is centered around the city's music, fashion, and social life, focusing on the lives of several people who helped create that scene, including Mick Jagger, the Beatles manager Brian Epstein, hairdresser Vidal Sassoon, fashion designer Mary Quant, and actors Michael Caine and Terrence Stamp. Sean Levy is also the author of the book Rat Pack Confidential. I asked him what set the stage for the cultural explosion in London.
In the 50s, Britain had a really tough time recovering economically from World War II. While Germany and Italy were being rebuilt with the help of American money, France was recovering. The U.S. obviously was enjoying a very fecund period of commercial and even cultural growth. England was kind of stagnant until about the middle of the decade, when you had the advent of sort of the angry young men in theater and literature. You had a growth and prosperity that allowed families who had, you know, been living in houses with outdoor bathrooms and, the whole family crammed into two upstairs rooms, were able to afford a larger home, move to the country, that sort of thing, the suburbs. And the young people of that generation uniquely did not have to serve in the military. They were the first generation of Britons to be freed from the obligation to serve national service. There were art schools that were now part of the national education program. So if you weren't going to go on to college or university, as we would say, you could attend an art school and maybe learn painting or music. So a number of factors started to come together at the end of the 50s. And then there were a few places in London where the prosperity, the access, to, you know, the leisure time that young people had, the work that young people suddenly had, they were actually making more money in a lot of cases than their parents, sort of all came together. But it was about 1961, 62, even into the beginning of 63, that there was clearly something going on in England that was unique in the world. You know, if you look at American kid music shows of that time from television, the audience looks very square. You know, they could be watching Patti Page 6 or 7 years earlier. And you look at the British kids in 62, 63, and they look hip.
What are they wearing?
Well, the boys are wearing something like mod. It was skinny ties and lapels, very nicely cut suits. They had their hair done at hairdressers, not barbers. The girls were wearing shorter skirts. They had their hair cut shorter. They were wearing bolder colors, both the boys and the girls. All of that was new to England. And it was really, it would have been novel in America. You talk to some of the swinging Londoners about the first time they wore their gear to America, and they talk about getting stares for wearing things that nobody would have blinked at in London.
You mentioned that you were familiar before writing this book with the fashions and movies and music that came out of London in the 60s. What are some of those key cultural moments for you that define London in the 60s?
Well, two of the very early innovators are Mary Quant, the fashion designer, and Vidal Sassoon, the hair cutter. And you know, we've come to think of Vidal Sassoon in particular as kind of like a goof, you know, with his blow dryers and shampoos. But here was a guy who in the late 50s began to rebel against the tradition of hair dressing, of setting hair into place several times a week with gels and heat and expensive treatments and having women sleep sitting up so that they wouldn't look bad the next day and things like this. He figured out how to cut hair so that you didn't have to go to the hair salon more than once a month, say, so that your hair would be cut into the shape you wanted, so that it was much freer and looser. Mary Quant, similarly, using sort of the techniques and quality of couture fashion, designed sort of sporty city clothes, things that made young women look sensual and made them look different from their mothers. And that was a lot of it, that, you know, these young people had money and didn't want to be like their parents any longer. In music, I think the Beatles are a similar sort of thing, taking materials that had already been there and injecting it with a kind of verve that was new. In cinema, the Beatles' first film, of course, A Hard Day's Night, but at the same time you had British films, you know, of more serious weight, things like Tom Jones and The Leather Boys by Sidney Furey, that felt more like continental films than like American films. So there were a number of things that were happening in England first.
See, one of the things that's interesting for me about this period is during, you know, during part of this period, I'm a preteener growing up in Brooklyn, New York, and getting my, like, yellow miniskirt at the department store and having the neighborhood hairdresser give me his version of a Sassoon and a Sassoon haircut. And it's just interesting how all the stuff just, like, filters down to, you know, kids growing up in Brooklyn and all over the United States.
Yeah, it really was infectious, you know, and it wasn't offensive the way, say, you know, long hair and burn your bra at the end of the 60s was to the older generation. The irony is so much of Swinging London was inspired by America, the pop music. You know, people like James Dean and Elvis Presley were revered by the British, and they couldn't believe that they weren't as loved in America by the mid-60s as they were in England. Sassoon described Swinging London to me as the marriage of American genres with a continental sensibility, the French grafted onto the American as interpreted by the British.
My guest is Sean Levy, author of the new book Ready, Steady, Go. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Sean Levy, is the author of the new book Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London in the 60s. He's also the author of the book Rat Pack Confidential. I asked him to talk about what the Rat Pack was up to during the Swinging London era.
Well, of course, the Rat Pack, they were all older gentlemen, married with kids in most cases, and they were taking part of a different sort of license. You know, they had this kind of public image as swinging guys and, you know, sort of men's men, and they appealed to that sort of greatest generation. You know, they were the age of people who would have fought in World War II and become the sort of men in the gray flannel suit in America. And they had adult tastes. And, you know, it's funny. Sinatra's womanizing was part of his appeal, you know, to an audience in the early 60s, that he was unmarried and had this enviable life. The Beatles had to pretend that John Lennon wasn't married, and Mick Jagger used to hide his girlfriend, Chrissy Shrimpton, because they wanted to put forward a face of being youthful and clean and free and available. The Rat Pack owned things. You know, Sinatra owned the Sands Hotel, or part of it, and Dean Martin owned part of it. He owned a record company. He produced movies. The Beatles didn't even own their likeness. It was sold away to a kind of sharp character from London, and then a couple of companies in England and the U.S., and they lost hundreds of millions of dollars until they formed Apple and got it back. So there was a certain sophistication to the Rat Pack's party that the Swinging London people just didn't have. You know, I don't think a lot of them thought that it would be going on as long as it did. You see Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and The Who on stage today, and you couldn't imagine in 1965 that they would be doing it in 1970.
Now, you write a little bit about the Rolling Stones. In writing about the Rolling Stones, you focus on Mick Jagger, and what you really emphasize in Mick Jagger's background is this suburban upbringing, that this is a real, like, middle-class suburban kid who gets deeply involved with African-American rhythm and blues. Why emphasize the suburban middle-class aspect of his background?
Well, one of the great things about Swinging London that British people remember is that it was a time when the class system, which is so rigid in England, even really today, from the Queen down, was fractured. It wasn't broken. It wasn't scuttled. But there were perforations in it that there had never been before. So you could get working class people like some of the Beatles, like Vidal Sassoon, who grew up in an orphanage because his mother couldn't afford to keep him in the house. They were suddenly celebrities, and they were able to rub elbows with the daughters of dukes and duchesses. And Jagger was in a funny position. Mary Quant says that the smart thing to be was either very high or very low. The middle was dull. And Jagger came from the middle. He's in ways a fellow who had to sort of pretend to be more common than he was, but at the same time, when he was a hit, he had to then learn how to be with people who were from a higher station in life. And he has done that dance, that tightrope walk, more and more successfully than any of these other figures.
Now, one of the early Rolling Stones appearances in the United States was on the Hollywood Palace, which was a variety show in the 60s. And I believe that Dean Martin was hosting it the night
That's
that right. they were on. Is that like a real pivotal point for you, having written a book about the Rat Pack and a book about London in the 60s?
And about Jerry Lewis, whose theater that was. He actually built that theater
okay.
for his 1963 TV show.
So what does that moment embody for you? Dean Martin introducing the Rolling Stones on Hollywood Palace.
Well, he didn't only introduce them. He practically slandered them. He said, aren't they pretty? Don't leave me backstage with them. And he says, that isn't long hair. It's just high eyebrows and low foreheads. And later in the show, there was a trampolinist on, and Dean said, this guy is the Rolling Stones' father. He's been trying to kill himself ever since. And the Stones didn't hear any of that because they were in the green room, and they saw it a week later when they were in Chicago, and they were incensed. Bill Wyman told me Mick Jagger got on the phone and was yelling at their management in England that, you know, we'll never do this again. But it really is, you know, sort of a place where the two cultures, the aging dinosaur culture of great American showbiz, nightclubs, and the Borscht Belt and Hollywood is meeting this youth quake that it cannot stop. And let it be said in Dean's defense that when the Beatles had all those number one hits in 1964, the record that finally knocked them to number two was Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime.
Some things are inexplicable.
Yeah. Dean is my good luck charm. I can't write a book without him.
In the United States, most youth movements are met with some kind of adult or conservative adult backlash. Was there a backlash in London in the early 60s?
You know, there wasn't, not in the sense that there was here. And again, it's partly the difference between the two cultures. The British 60s was in large measure about joining in. People from the north of England, people from the east end of London, lower class people, people who might have otherwise been sort of fringe characters or had no real shot, were able to belly up to the bar, come to the party, and be part of the scene. Someone like Terence Stamp telling me, you know, without the 60s, he would have never been able to date the daughter of the Duke of Bedford. In America, the 60s, as we think of it more, was about protest and dropping out. So there was much more of a generation gap in the States, I believe, than in London. Also, the first phase of the 60s in England was smart. You could be a mod kid, spend all night in a nightclub in London on amphetamines, and show up at the next day at a bank for work because the way to look was to look good in a suit and have a nice haircut. You rode a Vespa, you looked like a responsible young lad. So it didn't quite give off the same creepy vibe that, say, a hippie did later on.
What ends this period in London's life?
Well, the drugs. Drugs changed everything in the 60s in the States as well as in England. You know, if you read histories of Haight-Ashbury, it's a little later and it's a little more severe even. The economics of England changed. In 1963, England had one of the most robust economies in the world. In 1966, the Labour government put a wage and price freeze on. So that narrowed down the opportunities. One of the people I interviewed told me that in the early 60s, everyone had a job. If you were a photographer, a model, a musician, by the end of the 60s, there were fewer jobs to be had. And the people who had shown over time that they could do quality work reliably and repeatedly were the ones who kept working. Sassoon, Mary Quant, the photographer David Bailey, the Beatles, Michael Caine, and the ones who were flaky and difficult to deal with or really didn't have much talent sort of drifted away. So it became smaller. Taxes drove a lot of these people out. The government started taxing people in certain professions at like 90%. So rock bands and actors had to leave to you know, keep their money. And the climate changed in such a way that the the British no longer had the monopoly. You know, for a few years, if anyone looked cool, they were English. People like Bob Dylan, Andy Warhol, Allen Ginsberg went to London to see what was happening. And the mode of being, the hippie influence that started coming in at the end of the 60s really wasn't the same vibe any longer. Swinging London was about, you know, looking chic and going to nightclubs and dancing next to the genius whose record you were listening to and things like that. And hippie was more about, you know, getting back to the earth and, you know, being free and wearing loose clothes. You can't do hippie in Hyde Park in January.
Now, your book is coming out at about the same time as the new Austin Powers movie. And, of course, Austin Powers just really spoofed the whole London in the 60s thing. Do you like the Austin Powers films? Did they at all inform your direction for the book? I mean, did you take any inspiration from that?
Well, it made it easy to explain to people in America what I was doing. Everyone in England, if you say the 60s, thinks about Swinging London. Everyone in America thinks about Haight-Ashbury. So if I said, it's Austin Powers nonfiction, everybody got it. And the genius of the Austin Powers conceit is that he gets all the cliches. It's partly a Bond movie. It's partly What's New Pussycat, which was partly made in England in the 60s. But it's done in a very gently mocking way in the style of the 60s. That first Austin Powers film has those little interstitial bits where Mike Myers is with some go-go dancers and they just freeze frame and then they go back to the story. That feels so much like The Knack and How to Get It or A Hard Day's Night or Help. That's, I think, the brilliant thing, to parody it in the form that the original took.
Well, Sean Levy, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Sean Levy is the author of the new book, Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London. This is Fresh Air.